And now for a segment called Just Something I've Noticed, brought to you by our friends at Motel 6. Just Something I've Noticed. We don't give enough credit to signs, and we really should. That sign over there tells you, great French fries. That sign over there tells you, this is your exit. And look at that legendary sign. It's the Motel 6 sign. It tells you, a great night's rest at a great price. Book online at motel6.com and use the code CPRedEye to get 15% off your stay at Motel 6 or Studio 6. With almost 1,500 locations across the country, there's almost always a Motel 6 or Studio 6 nearby. Look for the signs. And truck parking is available at most locations. Enjoy a clean, comfortable room at a great price when you use the code CPRedEye. That's the letters CPRedEye, all one word, for 15% off your stay at Motel6.com. That's a great deal. And that's Just Something I've Noticed. Brought to you by Motel 6.
Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
Hello and welcome. He is Gary McNamara. I'm Eric Harley. As we move into a Friday, it's not just any Friday, folks. It is St. Patrick's Day.
And I don't want to hear any stereotypes about we Irish people, all right?
Yeah. No, we won't be talking about how you all drink and fight.
No.
I'd say we all.
No stereotype.
Yeah, right. I'm Scotch-Irish.
Well, I'm as close as you can get to 100% Irish.
Well, so. We stopped off at the other island to get angry. And then we came over.
We have a great sober show.
We are sober.
Today here for this St. Patrick's Day. So much to talk about coming up here in a little bit. We found out who one of the secret Bidens is, but there's another now. Mysterious. But there's now
a second mysterious.
According to the New York Post, there's another mysterious Biden. So we'll get to that. Coming up, Russia and the American drone, the banking system. Oh, in fact, speaking about the banking system, the Treasury Secretary spoke before the Senate yesterday.
The president knows many people on Social Security.
Then why doesn't the president care?
He cares very deeply.
Then where is his plan?
He stands ready. To work with
Congress. That's a lie. Because
okay, that's and I'm sorry that it was working perfectly before, and I'm having problems with my computer as I do all the time, and so. But that's Senator Bill Cassidy saying, "Why doesn't the president care about Social Security? He cares deeply. You know, where's his plan? He stands ready to work with Congress." And he said, "That's a lie.
Yeah.
We have requested over and over again to get this president to meet with us on Social Security, and he refuses to do so." We'll get to all of that. But you know, I was thinking about the banking system, and we had, you know, it was interesting because it sort of caught me off a little bit off guard because we had storms and hail that has some monster hail that moved through the area yesterday. So I got to sleep probably right around 6 o'clock and slept great. But when I woke up, I had a message from one of my lifelong friends, and I've talked about him before, Jerry. I visit him every year in Tampa, and he left me a message, and it was just a minute long. All right, it was just a minute message long. He left me on a social media thing, so I think it was exactly a minute, so I don't know if that's the limit that he can leave on it. And he didn't get into specifics, but it made me think because he has worked. I met him working at a bank when we were both 18, and I realized that you know, he's still in banking today and works for a smaller regional bank now. But he's been in the banking industry for 50 years. Next year. Next year will be half a century in the banking industry. And he called me up and he just said, you know, I'm angry. But it sounded more like being frustrated with the sense of hopelessness that, you know, you're angry about the situation. But he just, you know, he said to me, he said and I'll be paraphrasing here, but he said, I work for such a great regional smaller bank. And we do such a great service. And he said, we're so proud of what we do. And he said, and I think he was being generous here. He says, then these boutique banks, referring, I think, to SVP and Signature Bank, you know, do what they do and they screw it up for everyone. Mm-hmm. And it's hard enough. And he just said, just wanted to vent on it. And I started thinking, because I started working with him at a bank in 1974. I worked at a bank all through college. And he stayed in. And a lot of my friends that I initially started working with at the bank stayed in banking their entire careers. Mm-hmm. And I just started thinking about the banking industry and, you know, the small and regional banks, because I started with the regional bank that I believe was just acquired back in 74 by a monster bank still at that time, HSBC. But they still had the culture of a regional bank. And I started, let me just talk about this. When you look at the way banking used to be, one of our other friends, Fred, that we started working with, when I met him, and I actually met him in college first, and then I started working with him. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, wow, you're also, and we all started out as bill collectors. And he had a deep love for banking. I believe it was in his family. And his goal was to be a bank manager. And there was a pride about working for a bank in your local community, even though it was a city, you know, a medium-sized city, you know, Buffalo, that I grew up in. There was a pride in working for the bank, because the bank was part of the community. And I'll never forget, you know, Fred, who eventually became a bank manager. And when he did, he was disappointed, because you went to that point then in the late 70s, early 80s, more technology came in. And the personal service of a bank manager, like my father, when my father would go in, my father wasn't a bank manager, but he would go into the local bank, even if they were a pretty large regional bank, everybody stopped by and talked to the bank manager. Everybody knew who the bank manager was. Things weren't done strictly by numbers. It was done by the fact that you built relationships, you know, with the bank, and you built it through that bank manager, and you did it through the rural and the regional banks. Even in the cities back then, you did it. It wasn't just a numbers game as it is now. And so the small and regional banks, and I don't want to sound like I'm a Mr. Fezziwig here from Scrooge. Remember, I will stick with the old ways. Technology was going to take over banking. Mm-hmm. But sometimes in the movies, they make it seem like whether it was Mr. Fezziwig and his regional bank or Jimmy Stewart in
It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life. Thank you so much.
Well, that's Blaine
and
Bart.
Yeah, it was almost as, you know, as if the banks were charities.
Yeah.
Well, they were never charities. And they should never have been charities. They were were a profit-making venture. But they were profit-making venture by building relationships with people. Those bank managers and those regional banks, there was a sense of pride. They were a part of that community. They helped build the community legitimately, loaning money out to people. And back then, you didn't have the tech. Okay, show me the piece of paper. There it is. They knew you. And I remember when I had left the bank and I'd gone into radio, and then it just didn't work out, and I ended up being a machinist. But I didn't have a great, you know, I didn't have a long work history. And I went in to get a loan. And I went to Fred's bank. And he loaned it to me. There was no problem. There it is. And I don't know how much it was at that time, $2,000, $3,000, whatever. I probably didn't have whatever they were looking at. I didn't have a, you know, long, steady employment with one company. I was always employed. But the fact is, he knew me. And he knew no matter what, I would pay off that loan. Mm-hmm. And I know that the credit rating, we've talked about credit ratings before and how many, you know, many of the experts will say, no, the credit rating does absolutely. If you have a credit rating over 800, you're going to pay your bills. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way that you can still do it. And I'm not saying you can go back to that, to the scale that you had it, but that wasn't a bad culture to live in, because when you took a loan out, you know, from your local bank, you weren't just taking it from, you know, the big, massive industrial bank, you know, that international bank, you were getting it from Fred. You know, there was a sense of, if you had problems with the loan, Fred gave it to you, Fred would call you. Mm-hmm. And there was a sense of obligation that you, and I think it's part of what you and I talk about today when it comes to, you know, you mentioned, I think, yesterday about John Taffer and Bar Rescue, when we would sit there and say, these bar owners that get into this incredible debt, it's almost like it doesn't exist to them. They're not worried about it.
It's on paper, but it really doesn't look like, and it's not, and you don't treat it the same as a, if you had $1 million in front of you, or if someone came to collect $1 million that you had built up in your business and they took that $1 million in cash away from you, that would be a very different thought. Now, I asked the question to apply it. I'll let you get back to it. To apply it to SVB or any of the other banks, was there any kind of is it generational? Is there any kind of culture there that lent to their type of behavior? Larry Summers yesterday talking about how it was the fundamental mistake that Silicon Valley Bank made, and that is borrowing short term, investing long term. So my question would be, if they made that fundamental mistake by his accounts, then who was in charge?
Right.
Did they have, and was it, what was their mission statement, if not the very fundamentals of banking?
And that's what I, you know, what I got from, and again, he didn't go into specific details. I'm sure that when I visit him, as I do every year, him and his lovely wife, Mary, and we hang out for Memorial Day, I'll get my, you know,
That's right. Jerry, Gary, and Mary.
Yeah, Jerry, Gary, and Mary. Yes, we've talked about it before. Mm-hmm. He'll, you know, he'll give me just a, you know, a huge mouthful of it. But of you know, he doesn't hold back. But it was almost like I just, not because I'm on the radio, I don't think he had any idea I was going to, you know, do this, or he expected that I was going to talk about it. But it just hit me. I went, wow, because I came, my first really experience in business was banking. And so and when you look at it, and he's just like, And you and I've talked about before, after the banking, you know, the collapse of the mortgage meltdown, because of the manipulation of the mortgage market by government, everything that went through there, where they gave, the big banks can't fail, which made it tougher for the small and regional banks. And remember the consolidations then.
Right.
But still they survived, and they survived legitimately to this point. And then bad actors, you know, you look at it, there's no reason. You know, we mentioned it yesterday and we chuckled about it because Barney Frank came out and said, well, I took the job because I needed the money. There's no way that Barney Frank should be on any bank's board of directors ever.
No.
After what happened with the mortgage meltdown. Being a board of director or having influence in a bank today, or many financial institutions, like, you know, you saw Janet Yellen, you know, it's like, just stop it. I mean, she was just useless yesterday, on it.
Yeah.
It's almost as if...
It's frustrating.
It's almost as if, you know, I'm on a board of directors of a bank. It's almost like it's an elite entitlement.
Yeah. No, you're right.
The qualifications don't matter.
Right.
And he was just saying, he goes, that, you know, we've got a niche, and we're a damn great bank.
Mm-hmm.
He told me, he just said, you could hear the passion. He goes, we're a great bank, and there's so many good regional banks out there, and they have a niche, and it's important. And here, these idiots are destroying, you know, are destroying it and hurting us right now.
Yeah.
And we've done nothing wrong.
Right.
We get punished, and, you know, and now he didn't say it that way. I'm adding into it, but I know that's part of what he would want to express. So I just wanted to say that because it's something that hit me big because my history, like I said, first starts in the banking industry.
And it's important to bring that experience, by the way, to our friends, my friends and your friends, that we've been, you know, that we've known for a very long time. There's a pretty decent chance, in fact, probability that eventually we're going to talk about you on the air. Whether you're testifying before Congress on a broken border, and we actually play audio of you saying things on the air, or you lend your very important experience, and that's the thing that Jerry did there. You know, that's one of the things that we think of. All right. So, you know, the old mattress money. I still know somebody, and I love this person to death. They're a family member, and they have a safe. It's a massive safe, and they keep some cash in there, not all their cash. They do banking, but they're not one of these, well, I don't trust the banks. It's more like, well, but if I need cash and it's a Sunday, you know, I don't know why they would need that much cash. I don't ask them their business, but it's this in the modern age we have gotten to where we can, and now I do it all the time for business. I do it all the time in my personal life. I have all of the different cash transfer apps where I can send somebody money or they can send me money. It hits the account. As soon as a text goes through, you can see it on your account. That's how fast things move these days.
Right.
And so I don't think that's a part of it. It's just in an equation where everything is moving so quickly. You look at Silicon Valley Bank, and my question is, were they focused on all these other things and not focused on, like Larry Summers said yesterday, the fundamentals? And this is, you know, very basics of banking. You don't lend, you don't borrow short term and then invest long term.
Well,
and you broke a very fundamental rule. And I guess we'll find that out soon enough. But my question would be, is it isolated to that bank? If it is a cultural or generational thing, or, you know, or was it a temporary thing where they just didn't have the right people doing the right jobs?
When I talk to Jerry, I'm sure it's part of the whole morality. You know, he's been in banking for half a century now,
mm-hmm.
and he's seen everything, but he's always been a person in the banking industry. And he said so many of these, you know, small and regional banks are, you know, they're about integrity. They're about honesty. They're about solid financial fundamentals. And what we see in our country, we talked about this before, the people that do wrong get bailed out and everybody else has to pay for it.
Right.
And I think that's really what his thing was, you know, the morality of the fact that we're doing everything right. The people, the bad actors there, the ones that are irresponsible, are doing it wrong. The government bails them out, in essence, giving them an advantage.
Yeah.
The regional banks then are all viewed as, well, we need to be in the big bankings, so the deposits are pulled out.
Right.
We get screwed over for doing the right thing. They benefit from doing the wrong thing.
And while the
I think that's part of the frustration.
Right. While the government nurtures an environment where risk is no longer part of the game, which means
right.
it's going to happen again. There's no way it won't.
But just wanted to mention that. Start off the show with that.
So. Yeah, and thank you, Jerry, for
thanks, Jerry.
That experience.
it was great that I got it, because it made me think just, you know, about how the banking industry and finances has changed in this country.
Well, my primary account is with a smaller regional bank, and I started with them years ago, but I really appreciate, you know, the bank that they are now. It's really great customer service. They actually make phone calls. Somebody answers the phone when I call them. And it's a great bank, and it's one of the reasons that I bank there.
866-90-RED-EYE.
It's not always easy to spring back from the harsh days of winter to warmer months ahead. From de-icing chemicals to hidden debris underneath snow and ice, winter conditions can do serious damage to your truck. Here's a must-do maintenance check to help you minimize downtime and stay rolling. Have your batteries tested and inspect your electrical system for any exposed connections, wires, or butt connectors. Get any exposed components repaired immediately, as the acidic nature of highway de-icers will erode any exposed connections or wires in no time at all. This report is brought to you by Shell Rotella. Shell Rotella, with advanced synthetic technology, is designed to help keep your rig running with more mileage and less maintenance.
Lines open for your calls. 866-90-RED-EYE on Red Eye Radio.
And now for a segment called Just Something I've Noticed, brought to you by our friends at Motel 6. Just Something I've Noticed. There's a lot more yawning these days. Have you noticed that? Yeah. And the bad thing about yawning, it's contagious. Now, I'm not a scientist, but I do know that's true. You see somebody else yawn, all of a sudden, you got to yawn. Do you know what helps to curtail the yawning? How about a great night's rest at Motel 6? Book online at Motel6.com. Use the code CPREDEye to get 15% off your stay at Motel 6 or Studio 6. With almost 1,500 locations across the country, there's almost always a Motel 6 or Studio 6 nearby. And truck parking is available at most locations. Enjoy a clean, comfortable room at a price you will love when you use the code CPREDEye. That's the letters CPREDEye, all one word, for 15% off your stay at Motel 6, and help curtail the yawning. That's just something I've noticed. Brought to you by Motel 6.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Carly, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. You know, it's been so long since I was in banking. You know, when Jerry sent that, you know, message to me, it just brought it all back. You know, it brought it all back.
Yeah.
You know, just growing up and the way that, you know, regional banks and local banks were, you know, a part of the community, and you could sense it and feel it.
Yeah.
And, sure. And I could feel that in his, just his emotion and his voice and the message that he left me, that, you know, here we go, that the, you know, small regional banks still fill a huge niche in America, and we're being screwed over. And we haven't done anything wrong.
Right. No, in fact, if you look at it, they've had to work harder.
Yes.
To you know, in whatever their mission statement is as a company, as an organization, in order to gain that trust, and especially in today's world.
And it's like, we're not looking for a handout.
Right.
We just, you know, if we're good players, we don't want to have to pay for the bad players. And we don't want the bad players to gain an advantage over us because they were irresponsible and negligent in their banking practices.
Right, right. In fact, that's in part what Dodd-Frank did. And they had to roll some of that back. But it was basically giving more leverage to the larger banks, not the smaller banks.
The Bonus Show.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Hardy, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. So I've got my St. Patrick's Day shirt on.
But you're an amateur compared to what I saw today. Right after you and I spoke, we were talking about the weather on the phone in the afternoon. It's a very nice shirt, by the way. I saw a guy get off of a bus, a local transportation, public transportation
bus. A bus.
Yeah, bus. Yeah, it wasn't like a tour bus, you know, it wasn't an artist on the road. It was a local public transportation bus. So he gets off, and he's got, and I'm a bit confused because I haven't been keeping track of the dates. This week has been kind of a blur. And he's got head to toe. I don't know if the pants were pajamas or not, but it was green pants with clovers all over them. Shorts over the pants that had green clovers on them. A long sleeve shirt with green clovers on them. Older gentleman, probably one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. I didn't talk to him. And a green hat, top hat. And I thought, oh, there's a kid's party somewhere around here, and he's the entertainment. He was just walking over to the shopping center. He started walking. I was there in the parking lot, and he was just walking through the shopping center doing some shopping. He was just dressed. And I thought to myself, well, then, you know, I looked at my phone yesterday, and it was March 16th. And I thought, well, what's he going to do tomorrow? If this is what he's doing on March 16th, what is he doing on March 17th? The actual St. Patrick's Day.
Now, with the last name McNamara, and going back through my family tree, I'm as Irish as you possibly can get.
Mm.
And without red
hair. You sure drink that way.
Don't
fight me over that, by the way.
Without red hair and freckles.
I am, normally,
we Irish, you know, the stereotypes, we accept it. But there's one stereotype.
That you'll fight people over.
That I will fight people over all the time. And it's not that we're hot-tempered.
No, it's just that you've been drinking.
No. It's not even the drinking.
It's a little bit of the drinking.
No, it's not. This is a totally sober comment here.
Okay.
As I hit the microphone.
Stand back up, Gary.
I just hit the microphone.
Balance
and it
for
spun around.
Some reason.
And I remember.
Uh-huh.
And I remember because this happened very early on in my talk radio career. I mean, within a year of it, when I'm talking about the issues. And I was at the St. Patrick's Day party. And this was in New York. And there were these Irish folks that were there.
Yeah.
Furious at me.
Yeah.
Like three or four of them in a group.
Right.
Because I did not fit a particular Irish stereotype. And that was, I'll never forget, they came up and they were fuming. You're Irish Catholic. Why aren't you a Democrat liberal?
Living in Boston. Oh, I just threw that in.
It was in Buffalo. And they were.
Why are you in Buffalo?
They were. And so the one stereotype that actually bothered me about the Irish came from the Irish.
I like that.
Why aren't you a liberal Democrat? You're Irish Catholic. I'll never forget that. I was like, wow, somebody's actually walking around angry.
Well, it's the Irish. They're always angry.
I think they might have been angry and drinking. I think they invented the
angry left. The founders of the angry left.
Well, I did see a lot of Ted Kennedy in them. I mean, that's so old that, you know, that joke is actually so old. There are probably some people that don't understand the joke.
Yeah. No, during severe weather yesterday, I saw one of the local weather guys say, half dollar size hail. Well, if you're younger, you probably have never seen a never mind. It's larger than a quarter size hail.
I thought the same thing. They said a half dollar. I'm like, nobody relates to that.
Pete Delkus
was watching that when he
WFAA,
said that.
Who always does a great job.
Half dollar. I'm like, nobody knows what that is.
Yeah. I was thinking about it because I'm an amateur coin collector. I'm just fascinated. I'm not a real collector. But I'm fascinated with certain coins and anomalies, especially because they're usually worth something. But I just love looking at coins. It just, to me, it's just fascinating the life of a coin and how far it's traveled. And I have some, I had some half dollars sitting in my nightstand drawer at that time. I understand it. Oh, yeah, I am old. Never mind.
Wow. I was thinking the same thing I couldn't go to sleep until all the storms. I had a storm, south of me and north of me, and the real bad hail was only about 6 miles north of me.
Right,
and they're following it in saying, and some of this is tennis balls. I'm like, oh, no. Because the only thing you're thinking of, if you're in the direct path, is I got to buy a new roof. What's my deductible?
Yeah.
And
I just put a new windshield on my truck a couple of weeks ago, and I'm thinking to myself, oi. And I was driving around. Yep. I was like.
But when he said that half dollar, and I'm thinking, there's a ton of people out there thinking, so a paper dollar and you split it in half. And well, that's
no,
pretty big.
I didn't even go that far, but no, that's a good point. Oh, it's the half the size of a dollar. That's huge. No, no, half dollar. I know, that's what he said, half dollar. No, it's a never mind.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, so that's the stereotype that I object to the most.
Yeah.
Not really. I mean, I burst out laughing. I'll never forget, because they were angry. I said, I'm Irish Catholic. Well, if you're using the Catholic part of me, that would make me a social conservative.
Yeah.
So I'm actually trying to have a conversation with them as to, and what does the Irish have to do with my, you know, so I said, because knowing me, I want to break it down. All right. So you say, right. I'm Irish Catholic and I shouldn't be, that I should be a liberal Democrat. And I'm not. Well, okay, the Catholic in there would make me a social conservative, would it not?
Mm.
I mean, you expect me to buy, if that's your argument, you would expect me to abide by the philosophy and the catechetical text of the church, right? So I'd have to be
I'd have to be a
social conservative.
Mm-hmm.
All right, then what about Irish or the Catholic part of it would make me a fiscal liberal? And they just looked at me like, whatever, you're an idiot. And they turned around and walked away.
Back to the bar.
So I'm like, okay.
Ordered some more rounds.
Went back to stew in their rage.
Pumping their fists in the air. Hitting things and people.
And ale. And no.
Spilling their drinks. just keep the stereotype going.
While tears flowing down over their freckles.
Yeah.
And
yeah, exactly.
And their red beards.
Oh, the guilt they're going to feel in the morning. You know,
see, you have to take the stereotypes and laugh at them.
It's all in good fun. Yeah, it's you know that this program, going back to, you know, basically the all night show, our flagship station WBAP, in going back to 1969, I'd actually have to go back and see what they were doing before Bill Mack, but Bill Mack, me, you. Joe Kelly, it's always been Irish. I'm Scotch-Irish, but it counts, that have been hosting the airwaves. Well, since 1969, we controlled the airwaves, the all-night airwaves at WBAP, on the flagship WBAP. It's always been an Irishman behind the mic since then.
I think it was my father one time, because somebody called up, you know, it was one of those calls, and said, you know, the Jews control the media.
Mm.
You know, that used to be one of the things that was out, you know, that people would say. And my father said, hey, I heard that call the other day. Actually, it's the Irish. You, Hannity,
he's like,
O'Reilly, because O'Reilly was around at the time.
Right.
I'm just, and he went through all these Irish people in the media. He goes, you guys control the narrative.
Right.
He goes, it's problem the Irish.
It's the Irish.
It's like, wow.
Yeah. It's, you know, I look at it and I had some fun doing and still doing, working with my oldest brother actually right now, doing some of the ancestry stuff and the family tree stuff. The stories that my dad wants to know, right? And because on his side of it, there were a lot of questions and there wasn't much evidence. So that required a ton of work, still is a lot of work in doing that. But it's always interesting in looking at it, you know, the heritage. And I like looking at the migration of people, actually, whether they're related to me or not, you know, where they come from and why they moved where they moved to, you know, and when and what that took back then. On my mom's side, from Scotland, the Burnetts of Leys, who had been in Scotland going back to William Wallace, and then all of a sudden they go to Tennessee and then to Texas. Samuel Burke Burnett became a Texas rancher, founded the Four Sixes Ranch that people may know from the show Yellowstone. But I think about where that lineage goes. I mean, they're in Scotland for hundreds of years that I know of. And then all of a sudden, there's this migration pattern. And I always look at that, and it's, you know, what was the draw of the United States back then, right? What would it take? Because what did it require for someone to pick up and then move across the world? You weren't just, you know, not that the covered wagon thing was easy, but you're talking about moving across the world. And to me, it's just fascinating watching that.
Well, when they did our family tree, that's when I found out. I remember the family tree was there and everything else, and I believe, I forgot who it was that told me. And I saw it and went, yeah. I think it was my nephew about 15 years ago. He said, well, you know that one of our ancestors is in the Hockey Hall of Fame.
Went, what? From the
National Hockey League, yeah.
Yeah, from the
George McNamara, who won the Stanley Cup back in 1914 with the Toronto Blue Shirts. And I think his brothers also, Harold and Howard, played in the NHL. I believe it was Harold, I'm not sure, who then won it in 1917 with Montreal.
Right.
And I didn't know that. It was like, wow. In a couple of years then, I talked about it on the air one time, and somebody sent me, they said, you know, George McNamara's hockey card is available.
Mm.
And I saw it. It was like, I forgot which website it was on. And I bought it. And my father has it.
That's an interesting period, too, because it was right before the Spanish flu. There was one year, either 1918 or 1919, that the Stanley Cup didn't happen because of the Spanish flu.
Yep. But finding the hockey card was unbelievable. It's wow. And it wasn't that expensive.
Crazy.
It was. I think it was less than $50.
My grandfather's World War I registration card. That is crazy to look at that.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
That
document.
That, that's I just love looking at that stuff.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Get in touch with Red Eye Radio toll free at 866-90-RED-EYE.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Carlin. I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. Okay, it was Howard McNamara who won with the Stanley Cup for the Montreal Canadiens, and it was 1916, so it was the year before. It wasn't 17 that the pandemic hit. So, And I will tell you this with all honesty. For all the elite athleticism that my ancestors had, Howard and George and Harold, all playing in the National Hockey League.
Yeah.
None of it was passed down to me.
Yeah.
Well, none of it.
I'll tell you, the skills and the manual labor and everything that in my family tree, it stops with me. You're welcome.
Top of the Hour News is brought to you by Howe's Products. Visit howesproducts.com.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America and around the planet, 866-90-RED-EYE. He is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara. Good morning. Download our app today and listen when and where you want. That's our Red Eye Radio app. If you can't listen live overnight, you can listen when and where you want, when you choose. So there you go. I do want to play this yesterday from the White House press briefing with Karine Jean-Pierre. And this is really interesting because this is, you can tell that the White House press corps is getting angry that they can't get any answers and they can never they can never ask a question to the president.
Right.
And so it's brought up that the president's going to meet with the you know, with the prime minister of Ireland today. And you know, the whole question is you know, will they be able to ask questions? And you can hear it gets a little bit wild at the end.
Take one more. Go ahead, Karen.
Thanks, Karine. You laid out a very detailed schedule for the president tomorrow with the prime minister of Ireland, but it did not include a two-on-two press conference. Can you say why not and whether that might be added to the schedule tomorrow?
So you,
this
I think you're
becoming a pattern with a lot of the world leaders who are coming to the White House.
Look, I've spoken up to this many times when it comes to diplomatic.
You laid out in the briefing that it's not part of the schedule.
Right, and I brought it up many times and I gave an explanation. These are diplomatic conversations that happen with the country that are visiting, and it is something that is decided in that way.
Okay, very quickly, she's not answering the question.
No.
It's
no.
Like, why aren't you going to have a press conference?
Right.
Well, these are things that are what do you mean negotiated or, you know, because, no, it, why, basically they want to know why isn't the president speaking, and then they start attacking back here as a group, you know, saying he turns around, doesn't matter when he holds these things, he turns around and walks away.
Right.
He gets angry when he when we ask him questions. Here, this is great.
But there will not be a 2+2 tomorrow, as you just noted. But again, this is in coordination with the country that come to visit here at the White House. You're going to have an opportunity, or your colleagues will have an opportunity to ask questions during the pool spray of the Oval at the Oval that happen every time a head of state visits. So that is an opportunity to be able to pose a question to the president or the head of state that is visiting the White House on that day. But again, this is coordinated.
He's answered questions.
I hear you guys. Look, the 2+2 is something that is done in coordination with the country that is visiting. That is not something that is unilaterally decided. That is something that is in discussion with the other country. I was asked about the 2+2. I also was adding that there is an opportunity where press will be in the room.
She's just repeating what they haven't accepted to begin with.
Yeah.
She's repeating the same thing, and let's see this.
With the two leaders, I cannot speak to if who's going to take questions or who's not going to take questions. As you know, this is a president that takes shouted questions often, but the 2+2 is not a unilateral decision. It is a decision that happens with the visiting country in coordination with them. With that, guys, I'll see ya.
Thank you. Question about how you align with business affairs.
Did you hear that? I have a question about the mysterious Biden, Haley Biden, that one, and she just turned around and kept walking out very, very quickly. I wonder if she went to reporters yesterday, because that was the first question that you heard that she walked out where reporters screamed that, because that story expanded yesterday. This is where, I'm reading the New York Post, a couple of stories, where the money went, the Bidens and Biden associates that received Chinese cash. This is really damning. Now, the media is trying to ignore it, but the fact is, this is not the elephant in the living room. This is now the blue whale pod in the living room. We haven't said that in a few months. Elephants are small compared to blue whales, and very, very small compared to a blue whale pod. And just reading here from the New York Post, bravo to Representative Jim Comer for revealing just how much of the family business Biden Inc. is. Bank records newly obtained by his House Oversight Committee show that Hunter Biden associate Rob Walker transferred north of $1.3 million in 2017, not only to the usual suspects, Hunter and presidential little brother Jim, but also to daughter-in-law Hallie, son Beau's widow, and Hunter's brief fling, that's from the New York Post, plus another unknown simply tagged as Biden. The family that gets paid together stays together, it seems. Most of the big chunk of change came from a $3 million transfer from the affiliate of Chinese energy outfit CEFC to Walker. CEFC is now defunct, one of China's biggest private companies, and the main target of Hunter Biden's operations back in 2017, with the first son angling for a ultra-high paid board seat and equity stakes for him and Jim and an unnamed big guy, quote, big guy, end of quote, widely thought to be Joe. In fact, one witness, as we know, is willing to testify under oath, Bob Ulinski, that that is Joe. He's already stated that publicly.
Right.
The new records cast further on just how commingled the Biden family life is with the larger business operations of the Klan. There is no possible legit reason Haley Biden, who works as a school counselor, should have gotten a slice of the CEFC payout. Now, I don't see why Jim, I don't see why anybody should have gotten the payout. I don't know what services they gave to the Chinese energy company. What possibly could the Biden family, if the president has nothing to do with it, what services did the Biden family provide to the, and who was the unknown Biden to begin with, but what did the Biden family provide in order to get that type of a payout from the Chinese energy company associated with the Chinese Communist Party? This is a nightmare for this administration, because now the actual cash values are coming out, and the question everybody asked is, why is the Chinese Communist Party, through the defunct Chinese energy company, paying the Biden family and that amount right after the vice president was out of office in 2017?
Well, because
within a month after.
There's the question. If you look at, you know, because the left is, and the leftist media is doing this. Yeah, but the Trump family and Jared Kushner, but the.
Fine.
Hold on a second. Here's the thing. There is a long established history of their business dealings, what they have done, right? Who they are, what their job is, their role inside the Trump organization, all of that. It started long before Trump became president. Show me that with the Bidens. Show me all this Biden family organization, because wouldn't that be known? If all of these members of the Biden family are being enriched, what is that for? What is their business?
What is the business that they're in? Now, stating that, as you just did, about the long history of Trump in business, we have said it. If you believe there was something illegally done, bring it.
Yep.
If you believe that Jared Kushner, and President Trump were involved in influence peddling, bring it forward.
Yep. No problem at all.
We are not justifying any lawmaking whatsoever. If you have an allegation that connects the dots of influence peddling on the Trump administration, bring it.
Right. I don't have any problem with that whatsoever.
And as far as I know, no media organization is attempting to censor the allegations against Jared Kushner.
No, I don't know of any.
Yeah, neither do I, because it's not happening.
And, you know, that's it. Again, show me this. And it doesn't have to be a long history. I mean, the Trump organization has been around for decades. But, I mean, if the Biden organization, family business, has been around even for a short time, wouldn't we know that?
Yeah, what's the business?
What do they do? Exactly what do they do?
Yeah. And so Haley getting that money, Haley, whatever, getting that money, really, that's the thing there. You go, oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Not that you still didn't go, oh, wow,
mm-hmm.
because that's the question. What do they do? What did Hunter do?
Right.
What did his brother Jim do? What do they actually do? Why is this money being transferred?
Right.
From a company with ties to the Chinese Communist Party.
Right.
And why is it being funneled that way? That's and so the last couple of days, and they're going to run from that. They don't want to answer any questions on that. Expect now that the Republicans are on this for Biden to even take fewer questions than he's taken already. And if that question is asked, he turns around and walks away.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's the problem with it. Now that you have, and remember, these are bank records, and these are banks that found, you know, suspicious activity, these suspicious activity reports, they're not Republicans.
No.
These are banks that did it. And there's 150 of them.
Yeah.
Relating to Hunter Biden and the Biden family, suspicious activity reports. And so, again, when you see, we've seen the polling, the public already believes that influence peddling has happened with the Biden family,
mm-hmm.
that the Biden family has been enriched by Joe Biden being in politics.
Right.
That's what the public thinks. Everything, all this adds another dot close to being connected, another dot being close connected, another dot being closely connected.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem with this for the president.
Well, and that's it. And
which is why nobody, even before this, was defending the president.
Right.
No. All you get is, oh, they're going after Hunter. Hunter's not president. And we all know the Republicans are not going after Hunter. They're going after the president. And they're going after the president because it doesn't matter whether you enrich yourself or enrich your family or enrich your family, who then, as Bob Ulinski and other evidence has shown, money and services was passed on to the president.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the things for his home improvements. Look, and things
there,
like that.
There That's, was concern by the Obama administration.
Yeah.
You can even take Trump out of it for a minute. This concern goes back years. And so, I don't know of anybody in public office, whether I voted for them or not. I know the Democrats don't think this way. Most rank and file, I don't know how they think about Democrats, how they think about Joe Biden. But we don't hear the same kind of, approach that you and I have had, and that is, look, if I voted for somebody and supported them, you know, for years by voting for them, if they did something wrong, that doesn't fall on me. If it's found that they did something wrong, then you take every measure necessary to make it right. I've never had a problem with that.
We've gone point by point on every allegation against Trump.
Right.
We've done that and said, okay, where's the law breaking? Where does it exist here? From Russia collusion, which again was a complete con by the mm-hmm. Democrats, mm-hmm. orchestrated by the Hillary campaign. We all know that now. Nobody denies that. We went through the other day what Bragg might have or what Bragg may be looking at.
Right.
So we don't sit there if there's allegations, we bring it up
mm-hmm.
and we look and say, okay, is there any law broken here? But it's the Democrats that wish to hide everything.
Well, because I think our approach, you know, has always been and quite often with people who support Republicans or with conservatives in general, I think it has been that I don't want that falling on the rest of the political movement. If that one person has done something wrong, then that person needs to pay that price. And we've said for years the Republicans are much faster to eat their own. I don't know if that's still the case these days, but I believe it is. And the point of that is, look, if you do something, then if we're supporting this party based on what they represent, what we want them to do, I don't want anybody getting in the way, even members of the party. And if they've done something wrong, look into it. There should be something done about it. Bring the evidence and move accordingly.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Most owner-operators leased to larger carriers are paid on a per-mile basis or a percentage of revenue per load. The per-mile basis is most prevalent among larger fleets, percentage at smaller. Pay per mile tends to dominate discussions about pay just because it's easier to measure, and pay per mile often is wrongly used as the deciding factor in leasing to a carrier. While pay per mile can be a vital factor, it's not a cure for every ill, nor does it mean a big settlement check is coming an owner-operator's way. Why? Because pay per mile always must be considered in balance with gross revenue as well as total costs. Gross revenue can include flat mileage pay, mileage pay that varies by length of haul, percentage revenue pay, and more. Most importantly, though, for every revenue dollar generated, only part of that dollar is profit. But for every extra dollar of cost saved, the entire dollar contributes to profit. Knowing and understanding your cost to operate is fundamental to understanding the true value of any pay package. Owner-Operator Business 101 is provided by Shell Rotella. Shell Rotella, with advanced synthetic technology, is designed to help keep your rig running with more mileage and less maintenance.
We'll be right back with more Red Eye Radio with Eric Harley and Gary McNamara.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 86690 Red Eye. I find this really interesting. You know, the effect of inflation, taxes, high cost of living. Mm. New study out found that a $100,000 annual salary is worth just $35,000 in New York City. Due to high inflation, the six-figure salary is being increasingly sapped of its value due to the purchasing power declines and cost of living increase. The study from personal finance advisor Smart Asset measured 76 different cities in the United States and found that the effect is felt in every city. Even the place where the salary goes the furthest, Memphis, Tennessee, it's only worth $86,444. The worst was New York City, where the salary is worth approximately $35,791 when taking into account taxes and the cost of living. Oklahoma City was found to have the lowest cost of living in the study, although taxes sent it to third place with $100,000 worth $84,000. Notably, seven of the top 10 cities where $100,000 goes the furthest in Texas were El Paso, Corpus Christi, Lubbock, Houston, San Antonio, Fort Worth, and Arlington, Texas.
Mm.
Well, there you go. Which the prices, whether it's Arlington or anywhere in the DFW area, are not that different.
No.
So that's interesting. I didn't know that. On the opposite end, the worst were New York City, Honolulu, San Francisco, Washington, Long Beach, California, Los Angeles, San Diego, Oakland, Boston, and Seattle.
Hmm.
In the three worst cities, $100,000 was worth less than $40,000. When you see that disparity, because that disparity is almost $50,000.
Yeah.
That's huge.
That is.
Yes.
Consider yourself canceled if you don't listen nightly. Red Eye Radio.
And he is Eric Hurley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 86690 Red Eye. Welcome and good morning. I just saw that the Philadelphia Fed manufacturing survey remains deeply depressed. seventh straight month of contraction. And we talked about the New York, the Empire State manufacturing survey that is down. This one came out yesterday. The Philadelphia Fed said its index for current general activity rose 1 point to a minus 23.2, the seventh consecutive negative reading. While it's an improvement from the minus 24.3 in February, any reading below zero indicates a contraction in activity from the previous month. So again, it's still contracting.
And the median forecast is that it would have popped up to a negative 15.5.
Yeah.
So that was a pretty good miss on that median forecast, which means there was something going on that the analysts had not expected.
And they said both the index of new orders, a critical metric for demand of manufactured goods in the region, mm-hmm. and the index measuring shipments have declined to their lowest reading since May of 2020. Yeah. Now, we know what happened in May of 2020,
yeah.
when much of the economy was locked down in the initial wave of the pandemic. The index of new, and that's incredible when you think about it. Because we shut down our economy.
Though. Right, yeah.
But the index of new orders fell 15 points to minus 28.2. Only 35% of firms reported declines in new orders, unchanged since last month. 7% reported increases. 58% reported no change. Mm. So that's what we're, 35% reported declines in orders. That's huge. The shipments index had a sharp drop, too. The Fed's report follows the Empire State survey released by the New York Fed on Wednesday. That index showed the business activity in New York State had continued to decline. The general business conditions index fell roughly 19 points to minus 24.6 from 5.8 in January. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course... If manufacturing is down and shipping is down, then you have that ripple effect throughout the economy. That means that fewer trucking loads going back and forth to the ports or anywhere from those, from manufacturing and that part of that leg of the shipping infrastructure, and it makes you wonder. If analysts are looking, if they've got so many misses, my question is, why are they missing? What are they not getting right now?
One of the things I was looking at, because we talk about, talking about New York State, talking about the Pennsylvania index, looking at particular regions and areas out there, one of the things was the census numbers that came out, the population change of states between in just, from 2020
right.
to the end of 2022.
Yeah.
And so we're talking about COVID through last December. Hmm. And looking at the states that had population increases over 100,000, okay, because you could look at that and say, that's significant. Texas, the population change, increased 884,000 people.
Hmm.
Florida, 707,000 people. Moving in, that's the population change. That's the increase in population. North Carolina, 260,000. Arizona, 208,000. Georgia, 201,000. South Carolina, 164,000. Tennessee, 141,000. Utah, 109,000. Idaho, 100,000.
Hmm.
So all the major increases in states, you look at the top of the states that were over six figures, all of them, are Republican states.
Yeah.
On the other end, the massive states that had losses over 100,000, Illinois, 230,000, California, minus a half a million, 509,000, New York, 524,000.
Especially with New York, you pair that with the cost of living where 100,000 is now closer to the value basically is $35,000 in New York. It's like making $35,000. Then you look at that equation, all right? What all's involved? Well, if you're going to tax business is going to move. If business is going to move, jobs are going to move. If jobs are going to move, people move.
I would like that disparity is so great. I have questions about their methodology.
On the 100,000 being a 35,000?
On the 100,000 being 35,000, well, for example, in New York City, and being, for example, in Oklahoma City, you know, 85,000, where there's a $50,000 difference. Again, I'm not saying it's not true. I would like to see the methodology of how they did that.
And they did say taxes and cost of living. So yes, there is an income tax for the city of New York and the state of New York.
Right.
In Oklahoma, it's one state income tax. So, you know, they don't have, Oklahoma City does not have a city income tax. Well, not that that explains all of it.
No, but the majority would have to be cost of living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
And so, you know, you can look at it, and if you look at New York City, for example, mm-hmm. I love the U2 guy we've talked about before, Cash Jordan. Mm-hmm. And I just love watching it. I love watching people that live completely different lives than I do with fascination of how they, you know, of how they survive and how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are things I look at that I watch all the time, and people say, oh, you want to do that? No, I'm just interested in people who do it. I have no interest in it myself. I have no interest in living in New York City, but he's a, you know, realtor there and going through all the different apartments. I'm fascinated by the places that people live in New York City, mm-hmm. and what it costs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was telling that to my dad yesterday. I said, Dad, it's incredible, because I'll sit there and this guy will walk through an apartment. I go, okay, that's nice. I could live there. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be a comfortable place, even though it's in a high rise, whatever. That would be a comfortable place. What is that per month? $9,000. Are you out of your mind?
Yeah.
And it might be 1,500 square feet.
Mm.
But it's a nice place. And I love the one they did one time. He went in, this one girl basically lives in a closet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was like 90, I'm not kidding, mm-hmm. 90 inches by like 70 inches. That's mm-hmm. her apartment. It's a closet.
Mm-hmm.
And you walk in and she could sit down. There's like a little, you know, a nice soft chair. Mm-hmm. There's the, a small sink, microwave, small refrigerator, mm-hmm. a TV up there. And then, you know, where does she sleep? There's a loft above it, you know, and that's it. And she has to cross the hall to go to the bathroom, you know, to use the shower and go to the bathroom. And that was like $2,000 a month.
A sandwich bag for her trash.
Yeah. By the way, I'm not exaggerating that at all. There's no exaggeration. This thing, my walk-in closet, mm-hmm. off my master bath, and I don't live in a huge house or anything, mm-hmm. but my walk-in closet is probably twice the size of the apartment.
Yeah.
And she said, well, I'm trying to save money. It's like, wow. I don't know if there was any windows. I can't remember if there was any windows. There was like a little tiny window maybe up above the loft, which she only had maybe, you know, 2 feet of headroom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like she can sit up in bed and read a book. And I'm like, wow. And so you look at that cost itself and you say, well, does that extrapolate out? I mean, how do you get that? You know, Oklahoma City is cheaper. Is it $50,000 cheaper? I'd like to see. I just want to see the methodology of that. You know, and they're not a government. It wasn't a Republican study that was done. It was mm-hmm. it was a commercial study that was done by Smart Asset.
Mm-hmm.
So be willing to see, okay, break it down, break it all down to me. I'd like to see that.
Well, and also, all things being equal, in Oklahoma City, mm-hmm. you're going to own a car. Not necessarily, though, in New York City.
No, that's a great point.
So if they said, well, this is what you would pay daily for parking, and this is what you would pay for gas and wear and tear on your vehicle in driving and stop and go traffic for you. I don't know if they figured that in, then, well, but do most people, if you live in New York City, do most people own a car?
Yeah, that's true.
And so, you know, there could be a number of things that might not apply.
Right. You can't, in a way, do apples to apples.
Right.
You know, that everybody has got the exact same things, because in Oklahoma City, you probably would own a car, which would make it more expensive. So if you extrapolate that out to owning a car and living in New York City when most people don't, then that would not be a accurate portrayal of the average lifestyle.
Right.
It might be an accurate portrayal of if you owned a car in New York.
Well, I would be curious to get into the breakdown of it, though. The fees, right? And in New York City and all of that. So, and commuter costs. Let's just say, okay, we didn't factor in owning a car in New York City. It was all public transportation or taxis or just commuting in general, the cost of commuting. And I don't know if they did an average cost, you know, but I would love to see the breakdown on the cost of government and the fees and everything else that you pay. You know, one of the things that we look at is, you know, is the cost of living in certain areas, but it is the policies that you put in place. So it is the cost, the total cost of government, not just the income tax. If a state or city has an income tax, it is the fees and everything else that is added to the cost of living there. And we've talked about that for many years in New York and in California. San Francisco came up just the other day. There are people leaving San Francisco. You look at the Silicon Valley thing. You and I touched on a story. It was a few weeks ago, and I can't remember if it was Business Insider that did the article that talked about the leasing of building space, that if you look at the tech industry in San Francisco and, you know, the Silicon Valley, you look at a number of people that over the past few years and companies, big and small, that have left. And so there was a ton of open leasing space in those buildings. And there's a reason, again, there's a reason for that. The cost of living, it's not just that they go after business, but it's a perpetual thing that if you increase the cost of living and crime is on the rise, fewer people want to live there. So companies need the talent pool. They want to be in a place where people love to live. And that's part of the attraction. Hey, come here, work for us. It's a great area, you know, and all that. But it's also the, you know, cost of living. It has to be amenable to moving from another location, possibly another state, to that area. Austin is one right now in Texas that is on fire. But you listed a whole number of, you know, cities there that with the very low cost of living. Right. In our state of Texas, but also in the South. I mean, you look at where the migration is in those states, in Arizona, Texas, and Florida, that are killing it of people going there. And why is that? Because the cost of living and also the treatment of business. Come here, we're going to let you make a profit. We're going to nurture that environment so that our economy can grow and maintain strong. And stay strong as a state.
866-90-RED-EYE.
We'll be right back with more Red Eye Radio with Eric Harley and Gary McNamara.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90 Red Eye. We'll tell you about the ex-Black Lives Matter activist who says the San Francisco reparations plan is gaslighting black people.
Hmm.
This is an ex-Black Lives Matter activist, which is interesting. It's like, so you've gone from that to more of a conservative in this short of a time. That's an evolution. And also, Senator John Warner, I don't know if you saw him asking, yelling yesterday about, this is the first, basically internet bank run because of rumors on the internet about, what was going on here. And, again, talking about the possibility of censorship of anything that would cause a bank run. And we covered this a little bit yesterday, and we said, well, no, the problem is here. Nobody believes the administration.
Right.
Anything the administration, you need to censor the federal government.
Well, that's the thing, is that you take risk out of the equation, the internet is not the problem.
Right.
When you take risk out of the equation, then expect banks to act accordingly, because we've been asking, all right, what happened at SVB? Did they have, was it unique to that bank in that it was a different type of banking culture? Or did they just walk around going, look, if something happens, federal government is going to bail us out? You take risk out of the equation, and you've got a big problem, and it's not the internet.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America and around the planet, he's Eric Harley. I'm Gary McNamara. We are Red Eye Radio. So download our app today, and you can listen when and where you want if you can't listen live overnight, like many of you are right now.
And thank you very much, and happy St. Patrick's Day to you,
yes.
Or as the Irish call it, Amateur Day.
Just imagine that Eric and I are sitting at the bar.
Because we are.
That's what we do. We're sitting at the bar, but we're not drinking. You know, and so all of you that are irritating us very, very quickly.
And so we're going to get up and leave. No, we're not going anywhere. We're going to stay right here. Yeah, I don't... I'm trying to think. I don't know, except for when I was very young and playing in bars, I was underage. I always had to have a chaperone because I wasn't of age to be there. So I couldn't really actually go into the bar. I had to stay in one area and have my chaperone there. I couldn't. And I didn't drink, but I was thinking, have I ever just hung out in a bar where, and then I didn't drink? Aside from that, not really. I don't drink anymore, but I probably wouldn't be sitting at a bar. It would have to have really, unless they had really great food, but that's a bar restaurant.
I only drink to excess.
Yeah. Well, what good is it if you don't wake up the next day going, okay, how much money do I owe and who do I owe it to? What, seriously, what just happened? Yeah, I...
You know, when I worked at one bar,
mm-hmm.
I never knew it, but I was... This is during college again.
Mm-hmm.
I was the beer-chugging champion.
Ah.
Nobody ever beat me.
Right.
I don't know how I could do it, but I could chug a beer. I would only do it once a night.
And just the one beer.
Just the one beer.
Yeah.
But people would challenge me every single night.
Yeah. Would you have friends that would invite someone to challenge you? In other words, you got to take on this guy.
All that the happened? Time, okay. Yeah.
Because that's what I'm picturing in my mind. Hey, Gary, come on, you got a new challenger.
And there were bikers that came into the bar.
Yeah.
And one time they you know, they had heard about nobody could beat this guy, and probably like seven or eight bikers came in, and the sound booth was behind the bar, like it was a corner. It was the bar went in a, you know, sort of a U shape, whatever, and the bar
right.
or the sound booth was behind the bar up.
Okay.
But there were steps that came down.
Okay, I see. Yeah.
So
everybody could
yell at you. Hey, could you play this? Could you play that?
Yeah. I've been in one of those. Yeah. I've worked those before. Yeah.
And so all of a sudden I heard clank, and it was, you know, like, what's that? And it was these bikers come in the door and put their helmets down there and said, all right, who's that beer chugging champion? I'm like, oh boy. Yeah. And
here
I won.
We go.
I won, and that's how I got respect of the bikers. You know, I had mentioned my buddy Jerry earlier when we were talking about, you know, he works for a small regional bank. And
right.
just you can go back to our podcast tomorrow if you didn't hear it, the first part of the show. When we started, I talked about, you know, his message last night about, you know, just about small banks. And, you know, he works for a small bank and regional bank and how important they are. And basically, they're the ones that are getting screwed over.
Yeah.
Jerry
yeah.
is also the same guy that when and we were working at the bank together. This is during college.
Mm.
And I've told this story before. Some of you might not have heard it because it's a great story. So he told me, he goes, hey, they have an opening at this one bar. I said, okay, yeah, to spin, you know, spin tunes. Okay, I'll do it. And so I went to try out, and they were going to try me out at midnight. They said, well, come on in at midnight, we'll try you out. You do an hour, and we'll see how you do.
All right.
So I got up there, and I had it all prepared. And the, you know, at midnight came along, and, you know, I said, hello, everybody, because I still hadn't gotten out of puberty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, but I can't remember what I said, but the first song right at midnight was the band Trooper from Canada. You hear the song all the time if you go to any NHL hockey game, and it's Raise a Little Hell's the song.
Yeah, right.
It's a very Detroit kind of, you know, rock pop song.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was the number one song in Canada. And we were at the border, so everybody knew the song. And when I started playing it, the whole place went bonkers. I mean, it was almost as if a riot was taking place.
Mm.
But I mean, nobody was violent, but they were jumping up and down. I mean, it was like Animal House.
Yeah. Right.
That's what it was like.
Right.
And it was that way for the entire hour. And I'll never forget, I come down out of the sound booth, the owner's there and the manager, and he looks at me, he says, you're the best damn DJ I've ever seen in my life. I've never seen anything like that ever. You're hired. So my buddy Jerry, who I talked about, he was there. He's the one that told me to, you know, to apply at that bar.
Right.
For the sound man job. So I go up to him. I said, I did great. I did great. He goes, no, you didn't. I bought everybody in the bar shots for the hour before you went on the air. He goes, you owe me about, I don't know, $50, $60. Well, that was a lot back in 1976.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, so I got the job because you bribed the customers.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite stories because I was like so proud of myself. He goes, nah, dude, you didn't do it. I bought everybody. I said, look, my buddy's going to be up there spinning tunes at midnight. You go crazy when he starts.
Yeah.
Here's a shot. Buy shots.
Right.
Now, you'd think that was a dangerous play. It wasn't a Tuesday night because Tuesday night, I'm not kidding you, Tuesday night was five shots for a buck.
Oh, all right. Wow.
Yes.
Holy cow.
I don't know if I would advertise that in the litigious society we live in today if I was a bar owner.
Yeah.
Even five shots for $5, I probably would not actively promote.
Well, I remember in the late 80s, early 90s, we would advertise in radio. We'd have clubs that advertised 99-cent or 50-cent well drinks
mm-hmm.
for a certain period of time, or all night, or ladies' night, where ladies don't pay a cover. And I think drink, at one point in one establishment, drink free all night. Well, it was so that guys would go there and spend
right.
money.
Right, exactly, right.
Alcohol aside, could you advertise that in today's society of, wait a minute, what do you mean? You're bringing women in. So that, and treating them, giving them, you know, alcohol or free cover or whatever it is, no cover charge, so that men can come in and hit on them. How dare you? I just think to myself, my gosh, that seems like another planet.
Yeah, they never, in Texas, I think there's a law against really promoting specials like that, I believe.
There is now.
Yeah, there is now.
There is now.
I mean, because
they haven't done anything like right. that since probably the early 90s.
Because you turn to some of the sports stations that mm-hmm. still play the gentlemen clubs commercials,
mm-hmm.
and they don't say, hey, great drinks. Mm-hmm. They say, hey, the ladies will be out and there's a free buffet. Mm-hmm. Hmm, naked bodies and free buffet.
Yeah, I don't think so.
No,
yeah.
Mm-mm. One or the other.
No.
Alcohol no, you can promote.
In fact, put more clothes on than you usually wear yes. when you're around my food, please.
And a hairnet and gloves.
Yes. A mask would be nice.
A mask.
I don't want any of... And no. Uh-uh. No, I've seen that advertised before, and I think, well, no. What are you doing? Put your clothes on. Sir, do you know where you are? I don't care. I'm having dinner. If you call that dinner. I don't even know what they serve, and I don't want to know, frankly. Yeah, no, I think about those times, and I think it was a totally different universe. Because I was watching some things. Somebody has put a ton of compilation clips on YouTube together. Norm MacDonald and... jokes you couldn't tell, basically the jokes you couldn't tell today. And a lot of it from his SNL days on SNL Weekend Update. But a lot of things that you couldn't do today. And, you know, and then I think about, okay, just watching an old sitcom. We talk a lot about Seinfeld, tons of Seinfeld references here on the show. But you look at that. And you go back to I was watching something that's not as old as Seinfeld, King of Queens.
Oh, yeah.
Reruns. Mm-hmm. And there were a few jokes, and I was going, that would not go through. We're talking network TV. That would definitely not happen on network TV today. And you think about it, and it is a totally different culture. I mean, our sensibilities have changed drastically because, oh, well, and it all started with, well, that's offensive. This is offensive. You know, and I heard somebody, a stand-up comedian, do a joke, and it was from years ago. It was from 93 or 94. It was like, oh, you definitely can't say that today. Unless there's no way.
Unless you're Dave Chappelle.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the best bar commercial that I ever heard, and I say the best bar commercial I ever heard because it's the only one mm-hmm. I remember 45 years later.
Yeah.
That me and my buddies will still say to each other, and we all understand and we burst out laughing. There was a bar in Buffalo, on Hurdle Avenue in Buffalo, called Gables. Mm. And they were running radio ads. And there was like a beat beneath it with a guy sort of, I don't know if he was sort of rapping or just talking, but it was... Mm. Meet your future wife at Gables, Gables. Meet your future wife at Gables, Gables. And we all remember it. I mean, 45 years later, that's the one bar commercial that we heard on the radio that we remember.
Wow.
Now, I don't think anybody was going to that bar for their future wife, which made it so unusual. I'm going to get drunk and meet a woman. My future wife. I don't know. Do I want to make that commitment?
Well,
walking into the door of that bar.
If you're starting, if your ambitions to have a family start with going to a ball, maybe a reset is needed. And you think to yourself, maybe I don't know, take a few years to myself. And do something, and then I decide to do maybe go somewhere else and, I don't know, start your family.
Now, see, one of the best songs ever written about a bar was actually by Johnny Resnick and the Goo Goo Dolls,
mm-hmm.
Broadway, which is actually the strip of bars on Broadway mm-hmm. that we used to go to when I was a steelworker.
Right.
And all those bars were right there
right.
On Broadway. And when he says, see a young man sitting at an old man's bar waiting for his turn to die.
Mm.
And I've been in those bars, and that fit the culture perfectly. The old guys were at the bar, the other, you know, young people would come in, and then you'd see the slow evolution over the years when Resnick sang that, I went, I relate to that. I relate to that.
The only setting that I've, where I've, and I've been to those bars too, where it's like, okay, you know, you belly up to the bar and you're just sitting there. You know, it's not, there's no music going on. You're not hanging out with a group of friends and all laughing. And it's just a bar where just people just belly up to the bar. You order, you sit, and you drink. I've been to, I don't know, in my life, I guess, I don't know how many, but the only time I've actually done that, where I've just bellied up to a bar and had a beer, is at an airport, and that's only been once or twice. You know, where you just sit down, because I was just looking for a place to sit down, you know? And it's interesting when you walk into some of those older bars and tavern-type things, and many people will be going to them tonight. Don't drink and drive, please. But there are people that will hang out, and they just and they're really not doing much.
You know what movie's a representative of that was Barfly with Mickey Rourke, which we still, my buddies and I still do it today, where he sits there and he's got some cash, he's in the bar, and he raises it, he buys everybody a drink, and he goes to all my friends. Nobody is his friend. But it's like, and then what was the one, I can't think, what was the one with Steve Buscemi in? Do you ever see that one where he was... Oh, he went to the bar. I can't remember the name of that bar movie. And it was, I mean, it was like, you looked at it, you go, it's a pitiful place.
Right, yeah.
But he was great. I can't remember what that bar
Well, I no, I was. Mean, I've had and still have friends, you know, that have worked and work in the bar and restaurant industry. And you'll find that the individuals that work there and the individuals that go there are, it's, they know each other. They, you know, you get to know people.
Yeah.
And it's kind of their hangout because they sit and talk with each other. It's a very close-knit community, really.
The corner bars, for example, in the Black Rock section of New York, where my buddy Jeff's grandfather had a bar.
Yeah.
His father, my buddy Jess, his father was a police officer. His grandfather owned a bar and was a bookie.
Yeah.
True story. But the bar around the corner from that, Casey's, I mean, there was like a community of people. They were community bars. It wasn't the same thing, for example, as Barfly or the Steve Buscemi movie is Trees Lounge.
Okay.
Right. And but they were actually places, and you know, great fish fries, home cooked meals all the time. They actually were a community get together.
Yeah.
And kids would be in there eating in the back with their parents. It wasn't like a wild place or a depressing place.
Right.
At all. But there are some of those bars that were.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Mm. So, happy St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, don't drink and drive. Call an Uber, would you?
866-90-RED-EYE.
Lines open for your calls. 866-90-RED-EYE on Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Carly, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. You know, we talked about the other day how Senator Mark Kelly in Arizona, when talking to the Treasury Department, brought up again, you know, the censorship issue because of, you know, possible bank runs.
Mm.
I want to play this from, this is Senator Mark Warner yesterday with Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. He's dancing all around that also.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah.
Here we go.
The one thing, though, that I worry about, whatever regulatory system we had in place, the other half of what happened, that happened sometime between Tuesday and Thursday afternoon, where we've seen now the very first social media, internet-based bank run. To put this in any kind of comparison, you know, when WaMu failed, the largest bank failure in our country's history, $16 billion coming out over a 10-day period. I'm not sure what regulatory system anywhere, no matter how much capital, no matter how many stress tests, that would have protected any institution from a $42 billion bank run in a single day. That literally at that point was 25 cents on the dollar of every dollar that was deposited. You know, I think most of us have all seen It's a Wonderful Life. We realize that that money was off in small businesses and startup businesses around the country. Question I have is, who was playing the role of Mr. Potter? I think there were some, and I've been supportive of the venture capital community. I was a venture capitalist before, but I think there were some bad actors in the VC community who literally started to spur this run by virtually crying fire in a crowded theater in terms of rushing all of these deposits out. And I'm not sure that we have anything in our existing regulatory structure. And it's early on, and we need to figure out what happened and who missed this. But this notion that, you know, 25 cents on every dollar can...
We'll get to more of what he had to say coming up.
The Bonus Show.
And he's Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90. Right, I'm going to get back to playing just the last part of the audio I want to play of Senator Mark Warner. But this all relates to the fact that when Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona brought up the possibility of digital censorship because the run on the bank is led by social media creating a panic, Mark Warner's trying to make the same case to Janet Yellen. Let's play the last part of what he had to say to her.
Can rush out in a single day, and people who spur this online Tuesday and Wednesday night bear no responsibility, and the hypocrisy of some who are libertarian until the stuff hits the fan and then want relief is frankly more than a little repugnant. So early on, this is not normally within the traditional banking regulatory, but I think this will go down as the history's first internet-driven run. You have any initial thoughts on this?
Well, no matter how strong capital and liquidity supervision are, if a bank has an overwhelming run that's spurred by social media or whatever so that it's seeing deposits flee at that pace, a bank can be put at danger of failing. Of course, there's backup liquidity. There's the Fed's discount window. But this is really can be a threat to banks. And one of the reasons we intervened and declared a systemic risk exception is because of the recognition there can be contagion in situations like this, and other banks can then fall prey to the same kinds of runs, which we certainly want to avoid. But this was a bank that had a very high ratio of uninsured depositors. Insured depositors and retail customers usually do not run. We tend not to see runs among insured depositors, but the liquidity requirements and needs of a bank with such heavy reliance on uninsured deposits that are runnable, I think we need to think about that.
And I agree, and a complete concentration in an industry sector, but the notion, and again, I don't have a solution in mind yet, but the idea that there is no responsibility for the equivalent of shouting fire in a crowded theater and forcing that run, using technology as a mechanism to accelerate that, presents a problem that I think, I hope we could all kind of put our heads jointly together on. Thank you.
So he's talking about fire in the theater, which means he's talking about First Amendment thing.
Right.
Because that's the whole fire in the theater. Well, they were yelling fire in the theater. Why? There was a fire in the theater.
Because fundamentals, yes, the fire actually existed.
The fire was in the theater, but it's the fact that you take that, what he's doing, he's dancing around all the fact that the same with Mark Kelly was doing the other day, censorship. The only thing these people can think of is any problem that happens, censorship, and I will say this for Janet Yellen, as much watching her, for the most part, yesterday, is like me trying to watch Hillary or Kamala Harris speak. It's just, it's impossible for me to do so. I mean, it's just like, because they're just, they dance around everything. She didn't dance around it there. She actually got to the point. Well, the problem here is she said, you don't see her running the bank when people, you know, a regular bank where the vast majority of people have less than $250,000 in there and it's insured.
Right.
You only see her running the bank because of the idiots. So many of these idiots in this bank where such a huge proportion of the money was uninsured.
Right.
Well, it doesn't matter whether the internet existed or not. You're going to have a run on that bank.
Right.
Word of mouth will do it. But it's the fact that Warner doesn't look and say, okay, what did the bank do wrong? He's looking at this saying, well, the big problem we have to look at, because that was his major focus in the minutes that he had to speak, is the fact that the internet exists and there can be a free exchange of ideas, and that's a problem for the banking industry. And she looked at him and basically said, well, no, it's not. This particular bank is different than the regular banking industry where regular people have their money insured.
Well, and that's it. Because he brought up the fire in the theater. You don't have to have a, you know, the theater doesn't have to be fully engulfed. If someone yells fire and anyone sees flames, even in one small part of the theater, everybody's getting out of that theater for good reason, for real reason, and you hit on it. That's because right. There's a fire. And what he wants you to believe is that, well, nothing was going on fundamentally.
Right.
Someone yelled fire in a theater when there was no fire. That's not true.
No, it's not. And that's, but the first thing that comes to liberals' minds are censor. Right. First right. Amendment's the problem.
Right.
First Amendment wasn't the problem.
No.
In fact, the call of screaming fire in the theater, I'll repeat again, as you just said, and we've repeated this, there was a fire in the theater.
You can, you're supposed to do that when there's a fire in the theater, and that those are the very fundamentals that everybody has looked at. And when Janet Yellen is telling you that, she's not, at least in that regard, trying to spin this whole thing. No, you had a large portion of those depositors were not insured. That's why they have the run on the bank. They need their money, and there is no insurance. And if it collapses, their fear is they don't get it. Maybe the bank didn't have that fear, but the depositors right. did.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's on them. You shouldn't put it in. If you can't insure that money, if you cannot insure your funds, my question is, what were you doing? I mean, there's a ton of questions for the depositors that don't insure those funds. But they saw a fire. And if you're talking about investors and look and you know, any type of approach where they're going to assess the fundamentals of a bank like that, I would argue that if they didn't yell fire, it could have been worse
right.
for a number of people.
Well,
a number of depositors.
Look, there was no social media, but when George Costanza saw the fire in there, he cleared a path, shoving over old ladies or whatever, in order to get to the door to get out. That was the Eric the Clown episode,
yeah.
if you remember that.
Yeah.
Jon Favreau is Eric the Clown.
Right.
But when he could stands at his way out of there, there was, you know, it was a small fire, but there was a fire.
Right.
And there was no, he reacted in that way, and people will react whether social media exists or not. But it, again, it was almost like, I'm sitting there watching this yesterday thinking to myself, the Democrats are just trying to think of any way. Well, I don't know what the solution is, but, you know, First Amendment, because he was bringing that there's a fire in a, that somebody was crying fire in a theater, screaming fire in a theater, and there wasn't one. Actually, there was one.
There was.
There was one, but why would he bring it up? Why would that be his first thought? Because that's what liberals are trying to find anything that they can attempt to convince the public that censorship and the government controlling your First Amendment rights is a solution to the problems that we face today, instead of the fact of looking at, you want to censor people, stop the administration, for example, over the last 2 years from lying about inflation, including Janet Yellen.
Right.
When you build a organization of the executive branch that is not credible on financial issues and has shown over and over again they are willing to lie about inflation and its effect and then continue the lies now to say, oh, people are seeing relief now, when it's obvious to everybody that the people that are communicating to you and to the United States the fiscal health of this country and their pathological liars, don't be surprised when you go out there and say, oh, there's no problem at all, where people go, there must be a hell of a problem.
Well, that's and that's it. We can add to it the botched exit of Afghanistan. And for months, this administration, the Taliban won't be taking over Afghanistan. The Taliban won't be. Everything is fine. Everything is fine. Everything is fine. What about the Americans? Not the service members, not just the service members. But the Americans living in Afghanistan were being told a lie. Everything is fine. Everything is fine. So in that regard, they didn't yell fire when there was a fire.
Right.
They didn't allow people to have the proper assessment of the situation. They, in fact, they lied about the situation. And as such, those Americans didn't have the information they needed as to whether or not they were going to stay in Afghanistan.
So the problem isn't the wrongdoing or the absolutely irresponsible action. And you can sit there and talk about it. You know, that we're talking about people that decided to park their money in that bank, Eric. Millions of dollars. This wasn't because of a business. They were just parking their money there.
Right.
And that was being brought up the other day. Well, this isn't all people. We had the guy who called the other day. He said, you know, he did payroll through a bank that, you know, had used that, whatever. But that was all protected anyway. This wasn't the majority of that money.
Right.
The most of the huge amounts of money they were protecting were people were absolutely who the hell would put, you know, anybody who acquires any wealth always sits there and says, OK, what am I going to do with it? OK, what's safe right now? You know, treasury bills, investments, whatever, mutual funds. Very rarely does anybody park 10 million in one account.
Right.
You know, or 100 million in one account.
Unless it's if it's a high net worth bank and you could buy independent insurance outside FDIC, an insurance policy that would, you know, which you can do.
Right.
I don't know that that was available to anybody at SVB or whatever, but you, the point is you ensure that the money is going to be there.
Right.
Otherwise, why didn't you just put it in a safe? I mean, my question is that if you were worried about, why weren't you worried about that money just disappearing up until the run on the bank that you made?
Right. But the
why didn't you protect yourself?
The wrongdoing of the bank, the inept board of directors, the inept management, the inept regulatory agencies that are there. You know, we talked about this earlier when to start off the show and just said, you know, Barney Frank had no business that these board of directors are not, they're not putting these board of directors in some of these banks because of their banking qualifications.
Right.
They're putting them there as almost an elite entitlement. They have no business being there at all. Everything failed across the board, but you've got Mark Warner, Senator Mark Warner. Oh, the problem is your constitutional rights.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Right.
The First Amendment is the problem. I don't know what to do with it. I'm not sure what the solution is. But yelling fire, and when he lied like that and said, you know, that's like yelling fire in a theater, that I call it a lie because he was implying that there was no fire in the theater.
Right.
There was a fire in the theater. That's why.
Yeah.
Because he was saying it was immoral what they were doing. How is it immoral if a venture capitalist says, oh, my God, I'm going to lose all my money because it's not insured, and he tweets that out?
Well, that's the thing, is that
it's the truth.
What are you going to do? You're going to then put a regulation on venture capitalists. They can't communicate. They can't put out assessments, because think about that. Well, then shut down CNBC.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? If you're going to go that measure, then Jim Cramer shouldn't be on the air. Now, there are reasons why I think Jim Cramer shouldn't be on the air, but that isn't what I'm talking about. The government saying Jim Cramer shouldn't be on the air is very different.
But
I think he's inept. But if that's, you know, again, that's if you're going to apply that. And when they say, well, I hope we can all come together, that means regulation, which means controlling free speech, which there's no way it doesn't get beyond venture capitalists. It would have to get to the media. it would have to get to anyone who's posting anything that has any following whatsoever on social media.
Let's not actually look at the problem that exists.
Right.
Let's take away people's constitutional rights.
Right.
That's how liberalism, that's how the Democrats think. That's what Mark Warner was thinking. That's what Kelly was thinking.
Right.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Get in touch with Red Eye Radio, toll free at 866-90-RED-EYE.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Carly, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90 Red Eye. It just drives me crazy, though, with Warner doing that. And I was, you know, after Mark Kelly did it the other day, and then there's a back and forth. Well, maybe it wasn't Mark Kelly. Maybe it wasn't. No, Democrats. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Warner saying that. I'm like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
Right.
I hope it's recognized by the Republicans that here they are. They don't want to look at the people that are to blame. This is across the board. You know, it's like talking about my buddy Jerry, and who works for the, works for a small regional bank, saying, you know, there are so many solid small and regional banks out there that provide such a service. He's been in the banking business for over 50 years. And they've got to take the hit for the irresponsible actions of a few who get bailed out. And meanwhile, because of the regulatory things that the government does, makes those small and regional banks less competitive.
Yeah,
and it's just
right.
Like, and here in this case, no, it's your First Amendment rights. That's the problem.
Yeah, people talking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America and around the world, we are Red Eye Radio. Download our app today. Listen to when and where you want. If you can't listen live to Red Eye Radio, overnight. All right. So I love some of the reaction. Most of it on social media is, you know, pretty hilarious. So now that San Francisco, the board there, has said, well, yeah, well, we're seriously consider the $5 million in reparations plus the $97,000 of guaranteed income for 250 years, all debt forgiveness, and we'll give you a house for a dollar. We did a couple of days ago, just very quickly, the financing in our head and said, well, okay, roughly be about just for the $5 million reparations alone would be $250 billion. Well, what's the budget actually of San Francisco?
Right.
$14 billion. Well, that can't happen. All right. How much would it be per household? $600,000 they'd have to pay. It's like, well, that's not going to happen. So mostly you've gotten mockery out of it. That's what you've got, because it isn't going to happen. And it shows the unseriousness, because think about it. All the board and anybody in San Francisco is promoting this. They know it's not going to happen, but it makes them feel better. Now, we did say the one positive of this is the recognition of liberals in San Francisco, how racist and bigoted they have been, where the guilt is so large inside of themselves, where they're coming up with amounts that could never happen, because that makes them feel good. That takes away a little bit of their guilt that they feel for the bigotry as liberals that they practice each and every day through identity politics.
Right.
So that recognition that liberals understand we're the racists, we're the bigots, we're the ones that judge people by groups and not individuals, and therefore we're so evil that there need to be reparations for that. That is refreshing that we know that liberals recognize their racism and bigotry.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Right. Yes.
Now, some of the response has been interesting. On Fox News yesterday was former Black Lives Matter activist Xavier DuRosseau, who was on. He now works for Dennis Prager's group that does those the videos, the the conservative advocacy group. So, you know, his mind has been changed. He's now a conservative, and he was asked whether, you know, whether this was ever going to come or whether this was going to be, you know, whether this would ever come to fruition.
Here we go. Absolutely. This is never going to actually happen. It is so unrealistic to think that the average family in San Francisco is going to be able to pay $600,000 extra apiece. And, you know, when people look at this list of the things that they're recommending, the most alarming thing for most is the $5 million going to each Black person. But for me, as an American, I'm looking at this list and I see that they're wanting to sell homes at $1 to Black Americans. As an American and as someone who used to live in the San Francisco Bay Area, it's disgusting to me that we are more focused on slavery, which ended in 1865, then we're focused on the veterans who are on the streets of San Francisco, homeless and begging for spare change in 2023. That's where they need to start sending their money.
He also said this is 111 ways to gaslight Black Americans into thinking we need to be dependent on a system of handouts in order to be successful. Hmm. So, interesting.
Yeah.
Former reformed Black Lives Matter activist.
Hmm.
That would be an interesting conversation to have with him, because
my
thing to be, all right, what was the one idea that changed your mind?
Well,
what was the first idea that you heard that made you think, I'm on the wrong path here?
Or could it also be the organization itself, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and we saw that with there were a handful of individuals that made the news that were involved early on and then said, okay, this is what I thought it was. So I'm not sure, but that is an interesting, some very interesting points being made here. And that is, you know, look, from outside looking in, not being in San Francisco, but you don't have to be. I asked the question, well, wait a minute. All right. You're saying you're going to pay for these, you're going to pay reparations for these individuals. Now, what about other individuals who will tell you that they and their culture have been oppressed as well in San Francisco? I mean, we've talked about the miles long list of possible lawsuits to come out of this. But the idea that, okay, we're going to make this payment and then keep making the, you know, monthly payments and everything else that we're going to do here, and are you saying that you're going to end oppression? Not just going back to slavery, and not just about reparations from slavery, but many in the African-American community will tell you, well, no, there are things today that are still wrong. In fact, one of them used to play ball in San Francisco, football. So if you're asking, you know, someone, all right, what do you think? In the abstract, well, no, there should be something done to right the wrong. Well, but who is the victim and who is the oppressor? Well, all of these, again, there's so many different levels of questions that will lead to lawsuits the moment something like this is enacted. Are the questions, the very fundamental questions as a society that we've been asking for years? This is not the first time that the discussion on reparations has happened. It's just that they're moving in such a way. I actually enjoy the conversation because they pared it down to one city. and said, okay, because we talked about it. It's that conversation has been happening for a long time about reparations in general. But it's isolated now to San Francisco in a way that you can say, okay, well, here's the math. Okay. Here's what it would take. Here's the revenue that it would take, the money that it would take. And now who's responsible for paying it and who is eligible to receive it? And those questions are and will always be unanswerable.
Well, I personally like the free market competition that seems to be going on with reparations. For example, San Francisco saying $5 million, and that has made the state of California now up it from $223,000 to over $300,000 for their reparations plan. And then with the San Francisco plan, the free market competition continues, where California, now you have the push to say, well, this shouldn't go to California residents. We should offer this to bring people back to California. And yeah. And so we believe in the concept of federalism, where states and localities can have their own home rule. They get to decide what they wish to do. Therefore, you have 50 different states and a bunch of different experiences. And even though that we believe this policy is insane,
mm-hmm.
we believe that they should be able to do this if that's what they wish to do. And I would like to see a city like San Francisco go through on this, start paying out the money, and see the manure show that results in this and the huge liberal circular firing squad and the results of a bankrupt city when people leave. You know, it's like defund the police. It's amazing. I've been going on YouTube a lot recently and watching how the local TV stations, for example, in Portland, Oregon, are covering the downtown area.
It's fascinating to watch that.
It's fascinating to watch it, because you would think that the only criticism is coming from, you know, conservatives outside of Portland.
Right.
That's not the case.
Right.
Not the case at all. And when you see how some of the local media is covering it, especially the TV stations, and you witness some of you think some of these sections, you're in a third world country.
Yeah.
And they talk about inside of Portland the destruction of it. But again, what you're getting in Portland is what the people voted for. It's what they said they wanted. Everyone else, not everyone else, but so many stood on the sidelines saying, well, that's like saying I don't believe in gravity anymore.
Right.
And so I'm just going to step off the cliff, and then you fall down. You go, what's going on? This shouldn't happen. I fell down.
Right.
Well, gravity. Yeah, but I want to pretend that gravity doesn't exist.
I don't believe in gravity.
I don't believe in gravity. Gravity.
Why is gravity bringing me down?
Gravity is racist.
Yeah.
Gravity is part of the patriarchy. Therefore, I mean, everything else is. Why not throw it? And so they decided to throw out all the laws of human nature,
mm-hmm.
of science, of economics, which is incentive.
Mm-hmm.
It's, okay, let's demonize the police. The police are gone. What does economics say? I can rob that store. I have a huge incentive to do so.
Mm.
Why? I won't be caught. Yeah. I can do that. I can destroy my downtown. I can become, the one good story is, remember we played that audio of the homeless woman that said it's so easy to be homeless?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
remember
yeah.
Remember we played that audio?
Yeah.
There was actually, I read a story yesterday, actually some good news. She apparently, in that interview or another interview, another part of it that got broadcast, said, well, no, it's really, really hard, and I wish I wasn't here, but it's very easy to be homeless. But it's her siblings saw it. She has like 10 siblings.
Mm.
She now is getting the care that she needs.
Oh, that's a great
and
story.
So that was
great.
And so she's off it, and there's a picture of like it looks like her brothers. It wasn't all her siblings. I think she's one of 10 in there, and they said they've been wanting to help her, and they can't. They just couldn't reach her, and finally she had enough. Yeah. And again, in these particular cases, we, and I've had experience, I don't want to go into the details, with homelessness. You know, that has been close to me, that has been tragic in some case, one case, but very rewarding in another one, who is another person I know very close to me who is no longer homeless and is slowly rebuilding their life. The other one died being homeless. And so, you know, I've felt it. It's been very, 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 very close to me. And it was homelessness by choice. You know, it was homelessness by choice, not because of economic situations. And so there's a whole different, you know, I remember when Reagan said that, I think it was Reagan said people can be homeless by choice, and he was eviscerated for it. I know that's actually the case. There are people that choose to be, you know, that choose to be homeless that actually have other options. But when you look at it and you see the, some of the 10 cities that they have down there, it's a nightmare. And how close they are to the houses. I mean, they're right on people's, you know, if you look at the abatement in front of your house, what if that was right in front of wherever you live and all that was tents and people living there? And the, they were talked about the rat situation, rats now, because of the people out in tents and, you know, the food out there, the unsanitary conditions, and rats all over the place. And these neighborhoods are going, what in the world's going? I mean, they are, liberalism is single-handedly destroying the city of Portland, Oregon. It's and everybody knows it inside there. I mean, it's not like it's hidden and nobody's talking about it.
Oh, no, it is.
They're talking about it.
It is the existence. I mean, I was going to say it's the story. It's not even a story. It's just, it is the picture of what's going on in Portland. Undeniable.
And I was resident of Portland. I mean, I lived a little bit away from downtown. But I lived actually in Portland. I was a resident citizen of Portland, Oregon. I love Oregon. Absolutely love Oregon. And I think anybody knows when I worked there, I love it. One of the things that I'm blessed with is wherever I've worked in radio, it's become home. And I go to those cities and I'm you know, you go to a city and you're like, oh, where do I go? Or you just have that feeling. I go to so many, there's so many different cities that I worked in. As soon as I land there, it's like, I'm home. I'm home. I've got this home. That's a great feeling to have, and I always had that with Portland, even understanding the insanity of the far-left socialist anarchists that exist there. It is, there's so many good people there, and it's such a great place. And to see what has happened in Portland, I don't gloat over it because I'm a conservative. I'm heartbroken for the people of Portland.
No, it is heartbreaking, and I met a young lady who was driving me to the airport at an event, after an event, and she talked about moving from Portland, having to leave her brother behind. And he was going through a number of issues, and she was trying to help him, and but she couldn't get him to help himself, and so she felt helpless, and she said, I had to get out of there before we both were drowning, and she's helping her mother get out of there, and they're from that area. They're from there. And she says, it's heartbreaking to leave, and it's heartbreaking to leave my brother behind. And but I'm just going to have to be stronger somewhere else if I'm going to ever be able to help him. I've got to be strong myself. You know, if the if the mask drops, put your mask on first before you help someone else. And that's the, you know, that's what it comes down to for a lot of people. They have to leave that. And it's sad. It really is tragic.
It really is. But there was no other possible conclusion or consequence. I mean, these are the consequences when you enact those policies.
No, I mean, there's,
we knew it was going to happen.
And it's not going to change until there is a monumental shift. And I don't see that in our lifetime politically.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Hi, I'm Jen Loomis, a transport safety expert at J.J. Keller, and I'm here to share a tip on compliance, safety, accountability. Compliance, Safety, Accountability, or CSA, is the FMCSA Safety Compliance and Enforcement Program. Its goal is to hold motor carriers and drivers accountable for highway safety and to reduce crashes, injuries, and fatalities on our roads. CSA does this by assessing the safety performance of motor carriers and drivers based on data collected during roadside inspections, crash reports, and FMCSA investigations. Based on the data that is compiled, motor carriers are assigned a score. The carrier is then grouped with other carriers who have had a similar number of safety events. Carrier scores within the group are then ranked to determine intervention priority. Low scores are better, so carriers with the highest scores are those that are most likely to be targeted for intervention by the FMCSA. Interventions range in severity and may include warning letters, roadside, off-site, or on-site inspections, civil penalties, or operation out-of-service orders. This tip was brought to you by J.J. Keller & Associates. Visit us at jjkeller.com.
We'll be right back with more Red Eye Radio with Eric Harley and Gary McNamara.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. Wow. 3 years ago yesterday was the official 15 days to slow the spread.
We're going to flatten the curve, everybody.
15 days to flatten the curve started 3 years ago yesterday.
All right. Yeah, we're still working on that, right?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
I just saw that and I went, wow, that was just...
Well, and from the weight that I've gained during COVID, I'm now trying to flatten my own curves.
On your smart speaker, say, play Red Eye Radio. And if you're really nice, she might. Red Eye Radio.
And he's Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90 Red Eye, if you'd like to get in. Now, this was fascinating because we always talk about what the numbers are. We've talked about the state of college today, but how many fewer people are going to college now than maybe 10 years ago? You know, and the stats are coming out. Wall Street Journal had an article. More students now are turning away from college and towards apprenticeships. Apprenticeships are up 50% in 10 years. College. Those going to college. Let me see here. Down, I think it was 15%. There you go. And they go through all the different, you know, they're talking to different people out there, but then they give the actual... In the past decade, college enrollment has declined by 15%, while the number of apprentices have increased by more than 50%. According to federal data and Robert Lehman, the labor economist at the Urban Institute and co-founder of Apprenticeships for America. Now, we knew this was going to happen because it all comes down to what return on investment is. Are you teaching something that will give a person a skill that they will look at and say, okay, I can make money out of this, or are colleges becoming brainwashing institutions of gobbledygook? When you think about it.
Gobbledygook 101.
Gobbledygook 101. Are you prepared to work in the real world if you go to college today? If you go through everything that they're teaching there, with the critical race theory, the liberal transgender activist movement, and the focus of that in every single curriculum.
Yeah, right.
We need to teach math with feelings. 1 and 1 equals 3, because I'm crying about it.
Eric, what is your feeling on this equation? It's sad. What? Oh, well, why is it sad? Not sad that I'm sitting in a classroom with a bunch of morons. But I do wonder, look, if you get a degree in finance with feelings, and then go to work for Silicon Valley Bank.
Yeah, we've talked about that.
I mean, what is coming out of the colleges in terms of individuals who are capable of going to work, being productive members of society? And look, they're very smart people in the world. I'm not saying they're all a bunch of morons and they're being... Well, but the question is, are they learning the right things? Do they have all the skills? I don't have any doubt that the people at Silicon Valley Bank, for instance, are smart. I believe that they're smart people. Yeah.
I saw the CEO's vacationing took two first class tickets to fly to Hawaii. So
yeah, well, that's where you should be right now.
Yeah,
because if my bank were going under, that's not even going far enough. I would have been halfway across the world. I probably would have gone to New Zealand, but.
I'd be in China.
Yes, right, exactly. And so the question comes, are they learning the skills necessary, not just the education? It's not whether or not they are intelligent. Do they actually learn anything that can be applied in the real world, which has been the ongoing question, I think, for a number of years.
Well, when you see here, they talk about companies – Google, Delta Airline, International Business Machines, IBM, have responded by dropping college degrees as requirements for more positions and shifting hiring to focus more on skills and experience. Pennsylvania has cut college degree requirements for some state jobs. Maryland has set a state goal of 45% of high school students starting a registered apprenticeship by 2031. It gets back to what eventually it gets back to the return on investment. Once you realize that there is no free lunch, because what will it take? We've talked about what will it take people to take certain jobs. People just don't want to take these particular jobs. Well, what will make them take those jobs? Mm. It's the same thing that made people take those jobs that they didn't want 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You have no other choice.
Yeah, right.
I hate to go back to it because this is really old school. You don't work, you don't eat. Now people are saying, you're ancient, McNamara. You really are.
Well, that's only because you're old.
That's so cruel.
Well, no, but I mean, there was, for me, and I think a number of people, and I think it still exists to some extent, but I do wonder if our instincts are changing. Do people worry? Do they have that instinctual, man, I've got to make sure I stay ahead of everything? Because you build out the pathology of dependency. Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And we've talked about it for years. But at some point, you're going to get to the degree of people being complacent, frankly. And just saying, whatever. I'm just going to live my life. It won't. I'm too big to fail. along with the banks, I'm too big to fail. And those are the things that, you know, rewire the brain. I don't have any doubt about that. That we don't have the same instinct. My maternal grandfather and grandmother had to travel around in Texas during the Great Depression. They had to go from town to town so he could find work. And they moved a lot. They basically just went to where the job was. That's interesting because my brother, years later, would actually commute out in West Texas when he was working out in the Permian Basin. He would commute hours a day. I mean, a long way, because they, you know, the work isn't, they're not working right there in the town. They're working out in the field. And so you did what you had. You always did what you had to do. And it was about knowing that I've got to feed my family. I've got to put shelter over my head. That was an instinct that we've always had up until recently, I think. I don't think it's completely gone. I just think that our survival instinct is not what it used to be.
I think about college and apprenticeships, because here they talk about Zurich North American, an insurance firm, said it hired 92 apprentices last year, many right out of high school, and from more than 800 applicants. Most of the apprentices attended community college. They're based in offices across the country. They work stints in different departments, such as underwriting, claims, audit, statistical reporting, IT, cybersecurity, reinsurance, said the head of the company's apprenticeship program. And I started thinking to myself, I know when I went to college, and my two-year degree is in engineering and science, so I got, you know, basically there. And then I went into mass communications journalism the last 2 years, which was completely useless. I mean, completely and totally useless. Mm-hmm. And when I look back at college, and I can look at it and say, okay, if I'm going to be an engineer, probably I need that technical knowledge. You know, that technical knowledge you actually need to survive as an engineer. And I said, and then so part of my thought process was, okay, you need that if you go to a really great engineering school. Mm. You go to a good engineering school, that's good. And then I started thinking about business. I'm taking business in school. Well, and I'm just using one person as an example for me to question it. And yeah, I've talked about a young friend of mine, a single mom, real early in life, GED because of that. Single mom, no family support.
Mm-hmm.
Really, no family support at all. Problems in the family where there's no family support. In a period of 15 years, has risen unbelievably through the ranks of business and has a GED. And I was messaging her the other day because I haven't actually sat down and had a intense conversation with her for the longest time. And I said, you know, I got to have this with you, because when she'll write to me stuff, or, you know, write me an email, whatever, or if she's, you know, looking for something else, write me her resume. I don't understand half of it.
Hmm.
And I cannot believe the knowledge that she acquired in industry, you know, while making money, you know, going in the lower level positions and moving up to an extremely high level position in the business world with a GED. And so that makes me question to saying, well, wait a minute. If that's happening, you know, what she got in 15 years to me is better than getting a doctorate in business, in my opinion. Because she got it in the real world.
Right.
Not only was her education learning about it, but it was all the pressure. It was handling the pressure of the real world. When she was learning, there was no living in a fantasy world business.
Right.
It was all real every single day. And I thought about when I went to college, you know, and because I've been asked this before, what was, you know, you went to college for 4 years and you paid for it and you worked two jobs. What was the best thing that you learned from college? And it's easy for me, and it had nothing to do with college. It was the fact that I was working two jobs and going to college full time and working at the college radio station, organizing my time.
Mm-hmm.
Organization.
Making it work.
Making it work. Invaluable. At that young age, invaluable.
Well, because it really is about developing good habits and that apply to being prepared for, you know, and also making a contribution in the workforce. Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing was the fact that my father being, you know, always the engineer in him, and I'd mentioned earlier because we had talked about banking, you know, and the banking, you know, situation in this country right now and how I started in banking. But I had that banking experience, you know, and then I had my grandfather's machine shop was up the street, so I knew about machining. And a few years later, I ended up being a machinist. I worked in banking. I was a machinist, you know, did radio a little bit, you know, the whole club DJ thing. But I was good and confident in a variety of different things, so I was always willing to try something else. Mm. That was also a huge benefit in my life that had nothing to do with the actual education. So that's why I have questions in my mind. And I'm not saying that you might not have a great engineering school that would blow away 4 years in industry because you could learn. I'm not saying that that doesn't exist. And I'm not saying that there aren't curriculums where you could learn a lot. But the questions now are in my head, especially since I haven't gone to college. I'm trying to think how many years it's been in 46 years.
And, we'll and just how, say and in how, a number of years.
And how different colleges today compared to what? Because nobody would. You think anybody would have put up with the crap that exists on college campuses today? No way. It would have never happened.
Well, and, you know, there is something to that. You know, as you describe your friend, this is somebody who was hungry. And I mean that in the way that there was no. There was no other way for that to go. That person had to put themselves into motion and say that I can't be in this place and that I've got to be in a place where I'm going to be secure. My child or children are going to be secure, and I have to fight for that. That type of hunger retrains the instinct to what it should be. But when you teach kids, somebody will be there for you. Don't worry about it. Then you don't get those kids don't have those skills necessary. They just don't.
Hey, I mean, her choice was poverty.
Exactly.
Or surviving.
I'm either here in this place right. or I work to get out of it.
I'm surviving or I'm not,
yep.
In essence. 866-90 Red Eye.
Coming up, more with Gary McNamara and Eric Harley. It's Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Carlin. I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90 Red Eye. So you see that headline, Gavin Newsom fails to pass penalty on oil companies, will now try executive action. He couldn't get a deal with the dominant Democratic legislature in California to pass on the penalty to oil companies because even Democrats realize when you do that, it is trickle-down taxation.
Well, it's become, you know, everybody understands that Californians especially – the price of gasoline, of fuel, and in their state is higher than in other states. And they look at it, you're going to pass that along? You're going to pass along another increase to your constituents? Yeah. No.
This is Red Eye Radio. On Westwood One.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen. Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.